Previously on Unsolved.
John Kavanaugh believed that Joe could very well have been involved or could have committed the murder of Father Kuntz because that the nephew had at some point supposedly asked Father Kuntz for money and was turned down.
Do you still feel the same way you did back then when you called
them?
Yeah,
I think he killed the Father Kuntz.
Okay.
That's what I think.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, Season 3, The Devil You Know. I'm Gina Barton. 10 years after Father Kuntz's death, a lieutenant at the Dane County Sheriff's Department went public, saying they knew who the killer was, but the prosecutor wouldn't charge him. That was news to some of his own investigators who had worked on the case, including detectives Gwen Rupert and Jennifer Nyber.
He made a statement on camera, we have a suspect, it's imminent.
Yeah. In 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because we all went.
We're like, what? Oh.
Although the lieutenant didn't give the suspect's name, it was clear to everyone at the sheriff's department that he was talking about Brian Jackson, the 7th and 8th grade teacher at St. Michael's School, who had called 911 to report finding the body. The lieutenant made that statement after the district attorney had refused to charge Brian Jackson with the homicide. The prosecutor said there was no proof he had committed the crime. But still, the lieutenant and the detective who had worked on the case, Kevin Hughes, were convinced Brian Jackson was the killer. Retired Detective Don Johnson, who was in charge of the case before Kevin Hughes took over, thinks that may be one of the reasons the case is still unsolved.
So he had it jaded and convinced my supervisors, who had the audacity to go on the media and say that the case was solved. We just can't charge it out. Which is so tragic. That means nobody's looking anymore. Once you say it's solved, then it's not Joe, the neighbor next door, that I thought did it. Damn, I was going to call tomorrow and tell them I think it's Joe, and now I won't call.
Brian Jackson was born in Canada in 1973. His parents were very traditionalist Catholics. He was homeschooled by his mother for junior high and for high school. She taught him to speak some Latin, and she also arranged for a priest to come to their home church periodically to say the Mass in Latin. Because remember, back then, priests weren't allowed to say the Latin Mass very often, and not all of them knew how to do it. Brian came to the U.S. to attend Magdalen College, which was located in New Hampshire. Matt Abbott, the Catholic commentator, knows quite a bit about Magdalen.
Magdalen College was a small school that prided itself on Catholic orthodoxy. And so those who really wanted an authentically Catholic college education would have been courted by this school and presumably would, you know, have liked attending there. But I heard mixed things about Magdalen College. You know, I heard that, yes, they had a reputation for being orthodox, but it was almost cult-like in some respects. I suppose at one time it certainly seemed attractive because, again, on the surface, it seemed that way. But what you find, again, with a lot of whether it's people or these institutions, on the surface, oh, look, it seems wonderful and holy. And then you scratch the surface and you realize, wow, you know, there's a lot more to the story. And things aren't always what they seem.
In the mid-1990s, when Brian Jackson was a student at Magdalen, it was a really strict environment. There were no sports, and no rock and roll music was allowed. The dress code said boys had to wear ties and jackets, and girls had to wear long skirts or dresses. I need to point out that since that time, the college has reinvented itself, changed its name, and made quite a few updates to get accredited and so on. But back then, it was right in line with a lot of Father Kuntz's traditional Catholic beliefs, like his philosophy of parenting, which he talked about on the Our Catholic Family radio show.
Parents have a serious obligation toward protecting their children from occasions of sin. And they have a serious obligation to properly educate their children or to see for the proper education of their children in matters of faith and morals. And I fear that that has been seriously disregarded today, and indeed parents are guilty of mortal sin by neglecting the spiritual welfare of their children. We can see if they were neglectful of the physical welfare of their children, everybody would be aghast. But no one is concerned about the more important part, and that is the spiritual welfare of their children.
Matt Abbott tells me that shared philosophy is one reason Father Kuntz recruited Magdalene's graduates to teach at St. Michael. Another reason was that his best friend, Father Charles Fiore, had connections there.
Father Fiore apparently had a relationship with the school, as did Father Kuntz, and apparently, I guess because of the reputation that Magdalene had for being an Orthodox, albeit very small, Catholic college, you know, certainly individuals who attended that school would have been good candidates to teach at the school that, you know, Father Kuntz ran.
Remember, Father Fiore was very wealthy. He'd inherited money from his family's real estate development company. He was known to have supported Magdalene College financially. And Matt Abbott tells me he even remembered the college in his will. Father Fiore also knew Brian Jackson's parents. I couldn't figure out exactly how he knew them, but according to the police reports I've seen, Jackson did confirm that with the police. In any case, Father Kuntz was introduced to Brian Jackson and asked him to teach at the school. Brian told the police he was a volunteer teacher, and Father Kuntz provided for his needs. Here's retired detective Wayne Honer, who worked on the case for years.
Brian Jackson got money for his teaching only by what Father Kuntz would give him. There was no set salary. There was no set amount of money that Brian Jackson would make. If Brian Jackson needed money for gasoline for his car, Father Kuntz would give him a small amount of money for that. If Brian Jackson needed money for groceries, rent, everything that he survived on, he got what he needed from Father Kuntz. It was not like you earned $400 this week, here's $400. It was like, how much do you need to fill up your car with gas and buy groceries and pay your rent? And that's how much money Brian Jackson would get.
Detective Rupert told me Father Kuntz had that kind of arrangement with all of the younger single teachers, the ones who didn't have families to support.
They were more like he was kind of supporting them, and they didn't really have a salary. Those younger ones, like, he paid their rent. He gave them money if they needed some stuff. He worked on their cars for them, and the church slash he provided them cars, mm-hmm. You know, real junky, barely, you know, driving cars. They stayed up in Sauk, so it was, you know, a really short little drive for them. So, yeah. Yeah, it wasn't much like a salary for sure for them.
As the police started investigating, they heard about an argument Brian Jackson had with Father Kuntz the day before the murder. It had to do with a special event called a Eucharistic Day celebration. Peter Kelly and his wife, Christine, were invited to it.
And it's not for the entire parish, because they have other services and gatherings for that purpose. But it's a way of getting your pals over. And so what it would entail is it starts at the church in front of the Blessed Sacrament, and certain prayers would be offered up. But once that was completed, then Father Kuntz's approach would be to have his friends for dinner, and he would cook it, and he would cook prime rib, and it was a big deal.
Peter tells me these types of celebrations are usually only for priests. So it meant a lot to him that Father Kuntz had asked him and his wife to come.
The last night of his life, I told him that Christine and I were certain to come to his dinner party the following Saturday. And no, the dinner never happened. But I was honored to come to that, because it was to be included among his priest friends made me feel honored, because he had some really good priest friends, really faithful, knowledgeable, holy men. And I was just delighted that he would invite Christine and I to be there.
Peter has heard a lot about the argument between Brian Jackson and Father Kuntz. It started when Father Kuntz told Jackson the teachers were expected to serve the prime rib that night.
As I understand it, Mr. Jackson said that he was taking another one of the staff members to the theater that night and wouldn't be available. And I don't think that went over well at all, especially because it wasn't like Brian Jackson was scoring high marks for everything else he was doing there.
According to the police reports I've seen, Brian Jackson told the police about this argument. He said Father Koontz told him and Heather Godgen, the teacher he had planned to take to the opera, that they had a responsibility to be at the Eucharistic Day celebration. The priest told the teachers he was disappointed they would think otherwise. Brian Jackson told the police he and Heather were upset and they were venting to each other about it for about an hour on the phone that night, the night of the murder. Jackson said that in the end, they, quote, came to their senses, end quote, and realized they would just have to skip the opera and serve the prime rib that night instead. He said they got off the phone around 9 or 10. So part of Jackson's alibi for that night was the phone conversation with Heather. Other than that, he said he did some reading and watched a TV show about magicians. He said he never left his apartment that night and went to bed around 11. A few days after the murder, Brian Jackson moved in with Father Fiore. Some of the investigators didn't think much of it, since Father Fiore knew Brian's family, and he had a huge house, the place on top of a hill that he called Monte Cristo. Also, Father Koontz had been paying Brian's rent, so maybe he just needed somewhere to live. But some of the other investigators thought maybe there was something else going on. They thought it was pretty strange that two grown men would move in together, especially since one of them was a priest. It's important to keep in mind that homophobia was a lot more common back then than it is now, and Father Koontz was a strong believer in the idea that homosexuality was a mortal sin. Remember, he worked with Stephen Brady, an activist in Illinois, to expose sexual misconduct by priests.
He made it clear to me he was working on many situations within the church, many scandalous situations, if you will, much of it in homosexual in nature.
The misconduct they were looking into wasn't only about molesting children or picking up prostitutes. Catholic priests take a vow of chastity, so for them, it would be improper to have sex at all, whether it was a woman or with another man. Some of the detectives thought that if Father Fiore was gay, that could be a motive for killing Father Koontz. After all, Father Koontz took such a hard line against homosexuality, finding out his best friend had kept that a secret from him could have caused a fight. Or maybe Father Koontz found out Father Fiore was gay and threatened to make it public. Father Fiore was in poor health, and all the detectives agree, not strong enough to inflict the damage on Father Koontz that his killer did. But if he had a lover, detectives thought maybe that person could have done it. Several weeks after Brian Jackson moved into Father Fiore's house, Father Fiore agreed to let the police search the place. They found some photos in the priest's nightstand. Peter Kelly tells me a detective showed him these photos and asked what he knew about them.
I saw both of the pictures that were in the possession of Father Fiore. To look at them, they are not obscene pictures. They are not creepy pictures. They are not really inappropriate pictures, but they can add to an error. One of the pictures is a picture of Brian Jackson, who obviously just woke up wearing a robe, kind of loosely. And when I look at that, it's not an obscene picture by any means. It, you know, exposes part of his chest, but that's nothing. See more on a beach. My only question is, why is that picture taken? I don't understand it. Why was it kept? I don't understand that either. The other picture was on the veranda, the spectacular veranda of Father Fiore's home, where Brian Jackson is standing side by side with Father Charles Fiore. Father Fiore had a nice big smile on his face with his arm around this young man, Brian Jackson, who did not have a smile on his face. I'm not saying a couple of buddies can't put their arms around each other. You know, usually it's on a shoulder, you know, these are my teammates, you know, we just won the championship, it's great. That's not what this picture was. And I didn't understand it, and I certainly don't know who took it, which is significant. because what was going on there? I don't know.
Brian Jackson told the police he dated only women, and Father Fiore had never hit on him. But he did tell them something strange about the time he spent living at Monte Cristo. Here's Detective Rupert again.
Back in those days, when you had a TV system and you had like satellite or whatever, or cable, the TVs weren't that sophisticated. And if I changed the station in my room, it also changed the channel in your room.
Mm-hmm.
There was gay porn on the TV that, like, Father Fiore must have been in his room changing the channel, and it would get stuck on a gay porn thing, and Brian would be watching it in his room going, what? So, but we don't have any information that Brian leaned that way in any way, or that there was anything that happened between him and Fiore. Perhaps Fiore wanted it, but we don't have information that he did.
We'll have more after the break.
Hi, I'm Allie, and I work with Gina and the Unsolved crew here at the Journal Sentinel. What would the world be like if we all listened more? There's never been a better time to start listening on Audible. With Audible, you get access to an unbeatable selection of audiobooks, including bestsellers, motivation, mysteries, thrillers, memoirs, and more. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet. And now with Audible Originals, the selection has gotten even more custom with content made for members. At Audible, they have a bunch of popular true crime titles, including The Stranger Beside Me by Anne Rule, which tells the story of serial killer Ted Bundy. The author met him when they both volunteered at a suicide hotline before anyone knew he was a killer. Audible members can choose 3 titles every month, 1 audiobook and 2 Audible Originals you can't hear anywhere else. Audible members also get access to exclusive audio fitness programs to start the year off on the right foot. Listen on any device, anytime, and anywhere. At home, at the gym, on your commute, or just on the go. You'll also enjoy easy audiobook exchanges, rollover credits, and an audiobook library you keep forever, even if you cancel. Audible, the most inspiring minds, the most compelling stories, the best place to listen. Get started with a 30-day trial when you go to audible.com/UN or text UN to 500-500 and listen for a change. That's audible.com/UN or text UN to 500-500.
To get to the bottom of all these branches of the investigation, one person I really wanted to talk to was Kevin Hughes. Remember, he's the detective who convinced his lieutenant and some of the other detectives that Brian Jackson was the killer, even though the prosecutor wouldn't charge him. I found out Detective Hughes retired in 2011, and he definitely did not stay in Wisconsin. First, I heard he and his wife had moved to Costa Rica, and I begged my bosses to let me go down there and look for him, but no dice. I finally tracked down Kevin's brother-in-law. He told me Kevin and his wife had moved to Ecuador, and he gave me their email addresses. I sent notes to both of those accounts, but got no reply. I'm sure you're not shocked that my bosses also wouldn't sign off on a trip to Ecuador. So I never did talk to Kevin Hughes. But I did do the next best thing. One day last spring, photographer Mark Hoffman and I went to the home of Hughes' former partner, Randy Burmeister. Randy, who's also retired now, told us Kevin Hughes was very dedicated and very resourceful. And I have to tell you, even the cops I talked to who disagreed with Kevin's take on the Kuntz case said he was an excellent homicide detective, one of the best. Randy said he was working a different murder on the day Kuntz was killed, so he kind of played second fiddle to Kevin Hughes on the Kuntz case.
So, I mean, Jackson was probably the best suspect we had at the time. You always focus, you know, homicide 101 is you focus on family, if it's a family thing or the person that found the body. And he found the body, and there were some discrepancies that led Kevin to believe he was more involved.
There was a possible motive, too, that argument over the Eucharistic Day celebration. Randy Burmeister tells me he didn't find Brian Jackson's demeanor suspicious at all.
He seemed like a guy that was dedicated to teaching, and at least my interaction with him was somebody that still was profoundly confused about this whole what happened to Kuntz. So, and somewhat shocked that we would think he might be involved.
But because he didn't have as much information as Kevin Hughes, Randy trusted his partner's judgment.
It's not like I have a total picture of the thing, so, and I'm going to trust Kevin. I mean, all cops trust the other cops, especially one that you know that's good and decent and does the job the way it's supposed to be done.
Randy Burmeister still gets emails from Kevin Hughes occasionally. The day Mark Hoffman and I talked with Randy last spring, he said, maybe Kevin hadn't emailed me back because he and his wife were on a 2 or 3 month safari in Africa. I asked Randy what he thought Kevin would think about what's happening with the case today.
I think, in all candor, he would probably still think that Brian Jackson is a guy who would be put off by the fact that anybody else was being considered, because he just thought he was a guy. It's one of those things where I'll always know it and I can't prove it.
In addition to Randy Burmeister, I spoke with two other detectives who interviewed Brian Jackson. Both of them tell me they never thought he was the killer. The first was retired detective Wayne Honer. He was with Kevin Hughes the first time Hughes spoke to Jackson.
But when we walked out of that room, I remember Kevin turning to me, and my thoughts were the same, is that we both felt that Brian Jackson had nothing to do with this thing. Kevin, I believe, mentioned to me, he said, I don't even know why we're talking to him. He had nothing to do with this.
Clearly, Kevin Hughes changed his mind at some point, and Wayne Honer isn't sure why. Honer tells me he didn't find anything about the 911 call problematic, and he had some thoughts on why Brian Jackson may have made a statement on that call that some of the other investigators at the time found suspicious.
I suppose I'm a suspect.
Maybe there were a few shows or movies that he'd seen somewhere along the line that 911 callers once in a while do get the finger pointed at them as being a suspect or the first person to find a body. And I think Brian had enough time to think at that point to kind of settle his nerves, and I think he was just talking to kill time. And I think during the course of that talking, he probably had a fleeting thought that, hey, I could be a suspect in this thing. I didn't look at that. I thought it was kind of a strange thing to say, but in the context of all the rest of the 911 call and the actions of Brian Jackson, I kind of took it as this is somebody that is just thinking and filling in the blanks while he's waiting for the next bit of instruction to do, and says something that we thought was strange, but in Brian's mind, it was just something to say.
Don Johnson, who was the first detective on the case, told me, when she interviewed Brian Jackson, she walked away convinced he was telling the truth about his innocence.
We had a very long talk, and I remember really being hard on him. I don't think I work on people to try to make them crack. I don't like the way that sounds, but I think I did with Brian. I really wanted to push him emotionally, get him back to that day and what was going on. You need to push somebody. Are they going to confess because they did it and you got it finally? Or are they going to keep saying you're just dead wrong? So.
And that's what he
said. That was
saying.
Him. It was just there was no budge. And when somebody, I think, is pleading with their case as hard as he was, he gets emotional and he's crying about it. I mean, he really broke down.
Gwen Rupert, the lead detective on the case today, tells me Jackson is no longer a suspect in Father Kuntz's death. One reason was that new DNA sample the detectives found a couple of years ago. Detective Rupert thinks it most likely came from the killer, and it doesn't match Brian Jackson.
So does that definitively rule him out, or is that what moved him from suspect to person of interest?
He's not even a person of interest for us anymore. Okay. But there was another investigative tool that we used to rule him out, and it had to do with his very raw reactions and truthfulness in the 911 call.
Members of the Dane County Sheriff's Department were trained in this new technique for analyzing 911 calls a few years ago. It was developed by a retired police chief from Ohio and a retired FBI agent. They analyzed 100 911 calls in closed cases. According to their research, what someone says during a 911 call and how they say it can help police figure out if the caller is also the killer. They found that innocent 911 callers do several things almost every time. They make urgent and demanding requests for help. Their voices have a lot of inflection and emotion. They are not polite, and they use contractions because they're trying to relay the information as quickly as possible. For example, on one of the calls in the study, a guilty caller started with, "Hi, I've been shot, and my husband has been shot." The "hi" is kind of casual and polite, and the "has been" is not a contraction. So those are the indicators of guilt. Contrast that with a call from an innocent bystander, which started with, "I'm at the East End bar. Please, there's been gunfire. People are running out of the building. We need help as soon as possible." There's "I'm," "there's," contractions instead of "I am," "there has been," and asking for help as soon as possible, which the guilty caller doesn't often do right off the bat. Although I haven't heard the recording of Brian Jackson's 911 call, almost everything I know about it sounds like it fits the profile of an innocent caller, according to this research. Remember how Don Johnson described Jackson's voice on the call?
I think all you're going to hear, though, is the high pitch, "Oh, no," you know, when he starts going like that, when he's, I think, flips Kunz's head or whatever and sees with a mess. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you're going to be startled, is that how his voice just completely changes to this little girl.
And according to the police reports, Brian Jackson was definitely not polite on that 911 call. He curses a lot. He also uses contractions and asks the dispatcher why it's taking the ambulance so long to get there. And he answers all of the dispatcher's questions. Brian Jackson did only one thing that's more likely for a guilty caller to do than an innocent one, according to this research. The researchers found that guilty callers tend to talk about blood and brain matter, while innocent callers usually don't use such graphic descriptions. They call it the blood and brains indicator.
"There's so much fucking blood. I have no idea where it's coming from."
As I'm sure you can imagine, I really wanted to talk to Brian Jackson. I knew he'd left Wisconsin not long after Father Kunz's murder, but I wasn't sure where he ended up. In a lot of cases, it could be tough to find a guy named Brian Jackson. It's a pretty common name. There are probably thousands of Brian Jacksons in the U.S. Plus, this one was born in Canada, so he could have gone back there too. But the more information you have about someone, the easier they are to find. And I had quite a bit of information about this particular Brian Jackson. I found his new address, and photographer Mark Hoffman and I took a trip there last fall. The subdivision where Jackson lives is one of those places full of cookie-cutter houses.
I said every house looks the same.
We found his house and knocked, but no one was home. I left a note. He didn't call. We knocked again that evening. Still, no one there. Then we went back around 10, and there were finally some cars in the driveway. That told us he wasn't out of town. But I knew he had 4 kids, and I figured 10 o'clock was pretty late to be bothering them. If someone knocked on my door at that time, I know I wouldn't be happy about it. We tried again early the next morning, hoping to get there before school started, but the family was already gone. Until then, I had held off on calling because it's much easier to hang up on a phone call than it is to close a door in someone's face. But finally, on the third day, I decided I had to try calling.
"Hi, you've reached Brian. I can't come to the phone right now. Leave your name, number, brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. If you really need to get a hold of me, send me a text. All right, take care. Bye."
I left a message letting him know we were in town and wanted to talk to him. I also sent several texts, but he never called back. We made one more attempt to talk to Brian Jackson. Our crime reporter here, Ashley Lutheran, is a good friend of mine and a great reporter. About a month after Mark and I got back from our fruitless trip to Jackson's house, Ashley happened to be going to a conference near the city where he lived. so I asked her if she would stop by his house.
Excuse me, sir. Hi. I'm sorry to bother you. Are you Mr. Jackson?
Yes.
Hi, Mr. Jackson. I'm Ashley. I'm a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
That's next time on Unsolved. That's all for this week. To see the police reports that describe some of the interrogations of Brian Jackson, visit jsonline.com/unsolved. We've also posted photos, videos, maps, and timelines, so you can explore the case on your own. Unsolved is reported, written, and produced by me, Gina Barton. Our sound engineer and videographer is Bill Schultz. Photographer, Mark Hoffman. Artist, Lou Saldivar. Web designers, Aaron Coy and Andrew Malika. Our editor of local news and investigations is Greg Borowski. Our copy editor is Debbie Davis. Our theme music this season was composed by Evan Johnson. I also want to thank Donna Billmeyer, Miles Moffitt, Ashley Lutheran, Meg Jones, Tom Ketting, Rachel Piper, Emily Risto, Anissa Johnson, Rick Wood, Brian Kranz, Joe Hanneman, Elena Weissman, and Taylor Palmby for their help this season. And please support local journalism. You can subscribe to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at jsonline.com/deal. Thank you.